from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
It's just a horrific sight. I mean, you know, you don't expect to walk into a church and see something like that.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries. But this isn't a guns situation.
The president will need Xi Jinping's help if he's going to get North Korea to stop this nuclear program.
In Virginia, Democratic Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam defeated his Republican opponent Ed Gillespie, backed by President Trump.
Danica Rome was running against, Bob Marshall.
Who described himself as a proud homophobe.
He authored the bathroom bill.
Yeah, how much did that work for him?
He didn't want to get on the Danica Rome now, and she is the first transgender state legislator in this country.
A very, very good morning for Democrats.
A very, very good morning for Democrats. They haven't had a good morning like this probably since Barack Obama got reelected in 2012.
If you'd like to join the conversation about the week's news, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Bill Curry. He's our Democratic political analyst. Hello there, Bill.
Colin has his own show.
Yes, he does. He still has his own show here. And wow. And Tom Dutchick is here. He's got his own website. It's CT Capital Report, where you can find all sorts of stories. We'll go through some of the things that are at the top of the page in just a little bit. Tom, good to see you once again.
John, when last I saw you, you were at a farm-to-table restaurant in Mystic. No surprise to me, by the way.
It's very, very public radio. Very nice lunch, by the way. At the top of your site right now, a quote from the head of Fairfield's Republicans: "We got caught in a Trump tsunami." As we go through local elections, then maybe go into a little bit of what happened nationally, Colin. Is that what this is? Is this a anti-Trump tsunami that's sweeping across Connecticut and maybe the nation?
Well, just about rule number one of political analysis is don't extrapolate from off-year elections to national trends, even governorships. Governorships don't map very well onto much of anything else, particularly national things. You know, if you tell me the party affiliations of 10 governors, that doesn't really tell me that much, typically. Now, you might have to break the rule today. There's just too much of a pattern here. And what kind of pattern it is, I think, is sort of the larger question. The two things that I'm kind of interested in so far, anyway. So, yeah, you mentioned on Tom's site, Fairfield. One of those, I'll use this person as a symbol. I don't even really know him, but his name is Matt Jacobs. Young guy, ran as a Democrat for the RTM, which is the government body in Fairfield. And he ran, according to his father-in-law, because, like a lot of people, he was very upset about 2016, and he decided politics is something you can't sit out. You got to get in. People are usually inspired to get into politics in a very positive way because they like Ronald Reagan or they like Barack Obama. This might be an occasion where people are negatively inspired to go into politics. 20 years from now, you might see a Democratic bench that's composed mainly of people who are freaked out by Trump. The other thing I'm kind of looking at, it's a little bit early to get this granular and know, but there were a lot of constituencies who didn't turn out in 2016 or didn't vote for Clinton the way they'd voted for Obama in the previous two presidential elections. The question I have, and you can see it a little bit in Virginia, are some of those people, young voters, minority voters, are they coming back? Are they turning out? Are they also saying, you know what, you can't sit this stuff out?
Well, so maybe people not sitting stuff out. What are some of the races, if we focus locally, Tom, that drew the most attention to you here? What are you interested in?
Well, let me just step back for a second. If we see, we had some sound effects here. The Capitol Report Wayback Machine to 2009, guys, where the GOP, as you all may recall, picked up 25 seats in municipalities with a very popular governor at that time was Jody Rail. And guess what happened in 2010? Mm-hmm. Governor Malloy came in and rolled through the state again. So before we kind of get ourselves all worked up about the gloom and doom and the end of the Republican Party in the state of Connecticut as we know it, let's just look at this from a historical perspective. And as Colin knows, I mean, this is a kind of a peek in at time at where we are in the state of Connecticut. And it may or may not make a difference in 2010.
Maybe not 2018.
You guys stuck in the Wayback Machine.
Maybe not so much gloom and doom for the Republican Party writ large, Tom, but it does seem from what Colin's saying that there is a little bit of a reaction, people turning out perhaps because of the events of 1 year ago today, a very unusual election that animated an awful lot of people who may have sat out that election who say, I don't want to sit it out anymore.
Right. And until I think we see some exit polling data, if there isn't these local races. Look, you guys are all smart enough to know everything is local. Clearly in Trumbull, where everyone thought it'd be a referendum on Tim Herbst, and it was. And the Democrats rolled through Trumbull like a steamroller, took the council. I think people were a little bit shocked at the margin of Aaron Stewart's victory in New Britain, along with the loss of the council. So I think, yes, I think it's certainly not a good birthday for J.R. Romano today. But I mean,
but yes, for Parker Posey, it's also her birthday. I usually take the day off, but.
Bill, someday we all will.
Bill, some big thoughts on this before we get into some specific races?
I'm looking forward to getting into a specific race in my hometown and in a couple of others. But I disagree a little bit with both Tom and Colin. In 2009, the Republicans did well. And in 2010, it took the House. Tip O'Neill famously said all politics is local. He was wrong. Even local politics isn't local. It's not a coincidence that in all 50 states there was a Democratic wave. The data begins to sort of average out. And my own opinion is that every election is a wave election. I was looking to see if the Democrats had become depressed or were they still angry. And I would say that it's more toward their anger. But an even bigger sign looking at Virginia is that the Republicans are depressed. And the big turnout, the big difference there wasn't so much the increased turnout in the suburbs of Washington, the Democratic stronghold, but in the fact that the Trump people, Gillespie, a Washington lobbyist, you know, of the first order, who shouldn't be electable to begin with, but is the really living avatar of the Republicans now, a total corporate guy who's willing to mouth neo-fascist slogans in the rural areas. Those people didn't respond. They did not come. He won by the same big margins, but no one showed up for him. And so that's the real bad news for Republicans, that their own base, the very heart of their base, chose not to participate.
Did we see, though, if we got down to some of the local elections that you want to talk about, Bill, did we see that type of national rhetoric happening at local races? I mean, the idea of people maybe trying to appeal to a Trump voter in your hometown of Farmington, for instance. I mean, does that really hold true down to these municipal elections?
You know, I think to some degree it was. Of course, Farmington had all kinds of stuff going on that you don't have the time to want to hear about. But there was deep division within the Republican Party, and a sort of Tea Party-ish group knocked out all their incumbent slate. And they weren't going to do as well in a town like ours. We had a wonderful young candidate, Jay Asimzadeh, who did very, very well at the top. He didn't quite win the top. And I had a wonderful conversation with him last night. He just talked about having come here in 1979 as an Iranian refugee fleeing the revolution, and how proud he was that 43% of the town of Farmington didn't mind that and was accepting that and was moving, and he felt he was someday going to win this seat. And in Hoboken, a Sikh became mayor. In Virginia, a transgender candidate beat the author of the transgender ban bill in his own district. There were so many nice highlights to this. It's, by the way, not a Democratic organizational victory. This is the first victory of all the people coming out of the woodwork to reform and change this party. This was a working families party, Move On, Democracy for America. This new virtual Democratic Party had far more. Tom Perez was on MSNBC last night taking Democratic National Committee credit for this. I give them none. I give them none whatsoever. But is there a wave? And is that wave being infused with a lot of citizen activists in response to Trump? You bet it is.
Yeah, I think you have to think there's a wave. I mean, I said this at the beginning, the pattern's too big not to think that. The one thing we haven't mentioned so far is the vote on Medicaid expansion in Maine. And to me, that might be one of the easiest things to look at and say, well, that's about an issue. I mean, there's, you know, local politics are often about personalities or, you know, about expanding and refurbishing the high school or stuff like that. And even gubernatorial races can get like that a little bit. This was just about a question, you know, a fundamental question of policy. And a fundamental question of policy in a state that has Paula Page as its governor, a fundamental question about about a political matter that has kind of dogged the national congressional scene. And the voters of Maine spoke pretty profoundly that they're in favor of Medicaid expansion. There was an organized campaign against it. It didn't work. So, yeah, I mean, if you had to look at one thing and say, well, you can't talk your way around that question because it's really about a policy question, I think Maine.
Well, and it's also part of, I mean, the national political take on that was it was a rebuke to Paul LePage, who I think vetoed that expansion something like five times. People in Maine I talked to say, no, it was about people in Maine feeling like they needed expanded Medicaid coverage and not really anything about Paul LePage.
Absolutely. Right, which is sort of the Bernie message, right? I mean, ultimately, it's kind of like, yes, we do expect the government to help us out with healthcare. We do regard healthcare as a public policy right.
I feel like I'm the show's Maine correspondent. I just want to say that in Maine, there's a populist undercurrent to all this stuff, and it really came out in that vote. It shows that those economic issues can bring Democrats together.
Yeah, I also want to refocus it back to, as Bill said, some of the younger people who basically, because of Trump, became active in the Democratic Party in the state of Connecticut. It's a great story out of Hamden. It was written by our friend Paul Bass about Justin Farmer. And he was a 23-year-old young man, and he suffers from Tourette's syndrome. And when he decided he wanted to run for office, he campaigns with Bose noise cancellation headphones on to kind of tune out the world to help him through his Tourette's. What brought him to his activism in the Hamden Town Council is the fact that he saw Trump being mean to disabled people, and he wanted to lend his voice to fight against the inequities that he sees in society. So I think in many cases there is a groundswell across the state of Connecticut in these communities, not directly tied to Trump, but certainly, you know, a motivating factor in many ways.
Go ahead, Bill.
You know, just one thing. In two towns that I love, my own town of Farmington and my next-door neighbor of New Britain, two new town chairs came in the last cycle, Brian Noah in Farmington and Bill Shortell in New Britain. And each of them did a spectacular organizing job. And it shows when you can't quite get that top of the ticket but you take everything else, it usually speaks a little bit to organization. And it was a demonstration that to me that the other piece of this is if the Democratic Party were ever to wake up and commit itself to the quality of grassroots organizing that Brian and Bill did, then so much would change. So much would change for the better in this country.
One thing I have to say is if you're a Republican planning to run either for your incumbent seat or to challenge for a seat in the General Assembly in 2018, this has got to make you nervous. You know, I mean, it would depend a lot on, as Tom says, on the town you're in and how things shook out and stuff like that. And you can't draw a straight line for these municipal results to that. And I also wonder how it affects the thinking of people who might be getting into the governor's race, particularly on the Republican side. I mean, Themis Claridis is sort of the person in waiting. You know, is she a little bit de-incentivized by these kinds of totals? Just quickly in New Britain, too. I mean, Erin Stewart is not going to run for governor. I think she's sort of the Raphael Devers of Republican politics in Connecticut. You know, she's a very hot prospect. You don't want to rush her into the major leagues before she's really ready to play third base. He's the third baseman for the Red Sox, if you don't.
I'm sure every listener knew that. Yeah. There's no question.
Yeah, public radio
no
people,
need to explain those references.
It's NPR. Come on.
Yeah, really. Seriously.
Well, but, you know, Colin, so how about a unpopular governor in a state whose lieutenant governor is running for governor?
Well, she's not. Yeah.
Well, no, in that would be New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
And so how did that work out? It didn't work out very well. So I think Nancy Johnson, Nancy, I'm stuck in that way back
machine. That's right.
Nancy Wyman, I mean, she has to be sitting around going, oh, geez, I don't know about this one.
I think you're both right again, although I'm slightly look at it slightly differently. And I would just say that last time I was on the show, I said that the big question was whether Connecticut would be the only one of the 50 states in which the anti-Democratic governor wave was more powerful than the anti-Trump wave. There was some evidence yesterday that that's not the case. There was some evidence yesterday that anti-Trump is going to drive this process for a while.
I guess I just wonder about that. To pick up on that idea, though, Tom, if we look at what has happened with the legislature, I mean, yes, it was a bad way to go about getting a budget finally. But we did seemingly have some sort of bipartisan across the aisle work that was forced by the circumstances. And so I don't know if there's anything that we can draw out of these elections or an anti-Trump wave or anything else when it comes to, you know, running the state of Connecticut with some sort of fiscal responsibility. It seems as though people in Connecticut want a governor and also a legislature that's going to work together to do something more than they've done in the past.
Well, yeah, I don't know if they want that. I mean, I know you ran a clip from Morning Joe on your cold open, and I was listening to him this morning, and he was also talking about now what the Democrats need to do instead of compromising on tax reform is say, oh, I got an idea. You control both houses. You control the presidency. Why don't you get something done, and we'll take care of it when we're in power? And I've always advocated this bipartisan stuff in the legislature is far overdone. If I were consulting the Republicans, I would have said, look, you Democrats, you control the majority. You control the governor's residence. You take care of it, and we'll run on. That's yours, and we'll do ours. So that could have been a tactical mistake, you know, instead of holding hands and saying, let's all do this together. So next year, when all the mailers come out and all these districts, they go, oh, well, you were part of this the deficit, which is now ballooned in 2018, yeah. Which everyone knows.
Although the real two-party system is still incumbents and challengers. And for the incumbent party,
lobbyists.
And for the incumbent party, that was a big day. Well, the lobbyists are part of the incumbent party. But so for everyone running for re-election, which means all the people who were involved in that process, they probably felt helped. The legislature is despised at this point, and now just maybe 2% less so.
Colin, I wanted to mention a couple of other interesting notes from yesterday. Ernie Newton back on the Bridgeport City Council, but Waterbury voters shut down a comeback attempt by their former mayor, Joe Santapietro. Both men spent some time in prison. One had a good day yesterday. One had a bad day. And Bristol no longer gets a kick from cocaine.
That's right. So Ken Cocaine, the embattled mayor. I mean, I think that was a gimme. I think that was a layup. I don't think cocaine had much of a chance there. I mean, it was such a mess that I don't find that surprising. And then, you know, you look at Ernie and you look at Joe Santapietro. I mean, the difference between those things really does get back to the idea that politics can be very local and idiosyncratic. If I lived in Bridgeport, I might have some vague idea why Ernie could get back in office. If I lived in Waterbury, I would understand why Joe couldn't.
Well, but anytime Ernie Newton is in politics, for me personally, it is a very good day for me and my website. And let's not forget Drew Marzullo. If you're shoplifting clothes from a J. Crew in Clinton and you represent Greenwich, they're going to throw you out of office because you know what? Those people in Greenwich don't shop at J. Crew. That's the
retail.
Biggest problem.
Avenue
shoplifting, they may say, well, okay, thanks for that.
Hold on for a quick second, but I just want to get to a call for Hillary's in New Haven. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I think Colin McEnroe maybe recognized my name. Hillary Grant, we've sparred a couple of times on Twitter. I'm one of the statewide leaders for Action Together Connecticut. And over the last few weeks, I've been listening to pundits talk about how national elections don't really affect local elections. I've been hearing that, and which I found incredible because for the past year, since after the 2016 election, groups like ours, Action Together Connecticut, and a few other indivisible groups have been working intently on things like elections. Mm. And for the last 10 weeks, Action Together Connecticut has been having record-breaking phone banks. We've made over 330,000 calls into Democratic households to turn out vote. And we yesterday released a media advisory talking about a press conference that we were going to have on the steps of the Capitol today at 1 o'clock talking about Democratic victories.
Well, and Hillary, first of all, thanks for the phone call. I want to turn it over to Bill because, I mean, you mentioned grassroots organizing on the Democratic side. You were somewhat dismissive of the overall Democratic Party's role.
I tell
all
people, if you want to elect a Democratic Congress next year, don't give a penny to the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee or Senate Committee. All they'll do is back reactionary candidates in primaries. Look at this. Look where all the energy is. And it's in exactly organizations like this that are coming in to renew and to energize this party. By the way, if you just Google voter turnout or just try to get it, just do a research of across the country what it was like, you'll see how often Working Family Party, not Greens, but any organizations that do dual endorsements, you'll see how much of a role that played across the country. The old model is breaking down, and there are lots of reasons why it's hard to form third parties or new parties in this country. But this bottom-up transformation is really happening in the Democrat. It's a huge, huge phenomenon right now.
Waiting for the Republican Party in Connecticut to show up at some point, and organize and understand how the Democrats did it in 2009. And now the Democrats are finally realizing that they're organizing every single year in these municipal elections as well.
That's a change, and too. That's right.
And it helps them in the next election. So, yes, as Colin says, there's a lot of people, including probably Susan Bicewicz, who are sitting out there going, you know, I can probably do this. So, I mean, I don't think it bodes well for the Republican Party going into 18.
Grassroots organizing is great, except when it's not, right? And these things don't always work out the way that you want. And Farmington's a great example. You had grassroots organizing of Republican insurgents. They wound up deposing, as Bill said, the old guard. The new guard was unelectable. You lose the election. So most of the time, grassroots organizing is a great thing, but it's a sort of be careful what you wish for. I want to go back to one thing, which is there are not going to be many elections. This is one of them. I mean, you look at Greenwich, just to Hillary's point, you look at Greenwich and some of the people from Indivisible and some of these other kind of anti-Trump groups. One seats on the RTM there. There are not going to be a lot of elections you can win just on an anti-Trump sentiment. Ultimately, you got to stand for something. If you're the Democrats, you got to stand for the people. That's why I keep pointing at Maine. Maine should be a blueprint for a lot of Democrats across the nation to say, okay, there are things people want. We can advocate for those things. It's a mistake simply to campaign against Donald Trump. You have to stand for something. One of the things that I think made Sanders such an attractive candidate, everybody knew what Bernie Sanders was in favor of. People didn't always know what Hillary Clinton was in favor of. Everybody knew what Bernie was laying out. I think that's a big part of the coming.
But if I may just push back a little bit, I mean, the historic vote in Maine is in part because there's Medicaid expansion voted on by the people in referendum. Maine utilizes that, and they have over the course of the last couple of years. Voting for an issue, voting for something that you care about, something that's good for your pocketbook or not good for your pocketbook, does not have that awful problem of being associated with an actual flesh and blood person. And the people are so often the problem, right? I mean, the avatars for the thing aren't always as good as the thing that you're voting for. So the main vote may show up as some sort of a symbol, Colin, but it is just a symbol. It's not like a guy or a woman that you had to vote for.
Right. You need good candidates. There's no question. People vote for good candidates. They don't vote for bad candidates. On the other hand, I think you also need policy. You need policy with this. And if the Democrats try to run 2018 and 2020 as pure anti-Trump elections, they're going to lose more than they should.
And you can't be – and if you're a Republican, you can't be Trump light, as Gillespie figured out.
And that's exactly what –
you got to be all in Trump, or you got to be, well, you know, certain things I agree with him, certain things I don't. But you can't be wishy-washy.
And that's right now with the – you know, the head of the Connecticut GOP is sort of in this Trump light category and not exactly sure, Tom, what that party stands for.
Well, that's right. And, you know, and I think our friend, you know, Joe Markley, you know, who basically does run that Trump flag up the flagpole, I mean, he has to be looking at Southington now, which has gone Democratic in the town council. So, I mean, the Republicans, you know, have to have a come to Jesus moment in Connecticut, looking at these election results without panicking and say, okay, where do we go from here?
And I think of all the Republicans who dithered back and forth about whether to show up at a Trump event, about whether to endorse Trump in Connecticut. There were a number of their leaders who were divided about it. And the message to all of them right now is clear, to get off this wagon as fast as they can. And I just want to say that I think Colin's actually listened to me for the first time in our decades-long friendship. But the idea that policy should be driving the message and that policy drives politics itself – and picking up on that instance in Maine is such a good example of it. The worst thing that could happen to the Democrats is that they mistake this for an excuse for going on doing what they've been doing. The only reason Trump survives is that he operates in a policy vacuum, and that is filled by trivia and rancor and division and personality politics. And when the Democrats put a blueprint on the table that's as clear as that referendum in Maine, they're going to win big time.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about this with Bill Curry.
Dude, I got that from the musical Hamilton. I didn't get it from Bill. If you stand for nothing, what do you fall for?
Bill is our Democratic political analyst. Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show. Tom Dudchick is the editor of CT Capital Report. When we come back, more conversation about the results from yesterday and the one-year anniversary of the big 2016 election. You can call us at 860-275-7266. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news and some of the big election results from yesterday. You can join us, 860-275-7266. And we're talking with Tom Dudchick. He's the editor of CT Capital Report. And he reminds us, and I meant to say this, Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock, he's got a Capital Report program, a roundtable program, that's almost as good as this one at WTNH Channel 8. So thanks so much to Tom for coming in. Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, is here. And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, I don't know what's on your show today. I should know, but I don't.
I do. On a very different note. So for decades, people who were trying to avoid meat have eaten veggie burgers. But now scientists have gotten involved, and they're actually, in some cases, even using genetic research to try to create a veggie burger with some of the actual qualities of meat, including
bleeds juice.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, not just beet juice. There's something called heme, which is
actually... I'm a big heme fan.
Yeah. And heme as in hemoglobin, right? It's sort of basically a scientific simulation
It's a more hipper name for hemoglobin.
So have you tried all these veggie burgers?
We are going to be trying some of them. Your friend, Chris Prosperi, will be here in the studio with me.
Oh, excellent.
We will be trying some veggie burgers, including the Betsy Burger, which is a new one from Betsy Kaplan.
The Betsy Kaplan Burger.
I am sad I can't stay for that segment.
Let's get to a quick phone call. John's in Kensington. Hey, John.
I want to first say I disagree with all the previous speakers.
Okay, good.
All right. I think you're looking at the world through the wrong end of the telescope. I think that, this business of being empowered by yesterday's Democrats to say, don't give an inch, don't give an inch on the national level, don't compromise on the state level with the budget, make it theirs. That's not what America's about. America's about compromising with a two-party system. And I think the average voter, yes, the political activists want to fight to the bitter end. But the average Joe Blow, the guy that goes to work every day to pay his taxes and send his kids to college, want politicians to work together to cooperate and get along and build a consensus, come to the middle, and not just fight to the bitter end just because they've got an R on the top of their hat and we have D's. Hey, that's wrong. That's not American.
John, I really appreciate your phone call, and I don't know. I say this sort of thing all the time. I tend to agree philosophically with John, but I also don't love the sport that politics is, Bill. I mean, what do you say to John?
I would say two things. First of all, I didn't hear any of the pundits come out for extremism or non-cooperation or bipartisanship. I don't think it actually came up when we were talking. But I understand his feeling, and my own is different. First of all, bipartisanship works a lot better at the local and state level than it's worked in the national level for a long time now. And so I'd still advocate it there to a much greater degree. But at the national level, bipartisanship so far has given us the Iraq war, pay-to-play politics, deficits, no child left behind, the crime and welfare bills, all the great bipartisan initiatives, all of them, deregulation of Wall Street, are all in disrepute. And so I think when people say bipartisan, they mean civil, reasoned, and respectful. And I would just suggest that it's not bipartisanship between the elites of these two corrupt parties, but it's listening to each other's voters, giving the genuine conservative concerns of Republican voters a listen, and making sure that you begin to incorporate that in your thinking, to think less ideologically and more empirically, above all to respect people. In the last decade of my life, two decades, we've somehow taught Americans to hate people just for disagreeing with them. And that's killing us.
Yeah, Bill also believes in the tooth fairy. You know, does anyone believe that in 2007 when Jimmy Amon was Speaker of the House and the Democrats held a 104-33 majority in the House and 24-12 in the Senate, that they would care what any Republican said? I bet you Jimmy Amon said, hey, I got an idea. Let's get those 33 Republicans into our office and let's see if we can craft a bipartisan budget.
No.
It would never happen, Bill. And the only reason the Democrats in the state of Connecticut even take phone calls from Themis and from Len Fasano is because they need the votes to pass something.
Yeah,
if
I think that's right.
If it wasn't that the case, they would be shut out totally.
Yeah. I'm not sure I said what you're responding to. But
you didn't actually.
But my point was that the bipartisanship I want is to first and foremost listen to the legitimate concerns of the voters themselves. I learned a lot from debating Bill Buckley in those years. I learned a lot from my Republican colleagues when I was a state senator. I learned less from the elected officials now because they're so extreme and so partisan, but I still learn from the voters and the thinkers and the open-minded people. And I think that the sort of that bipartisan rubric really is about something else that we're not doing. It's about reason, civility, empiricism, and it's about being willing to learn from one another as citizens.
I think, just to respond to the caller, I mean, one of the problems right now, and I think Bill's right, at the national level, it's hard to get bipartisanship for a bunch of different reasons, including the fact that because of money in politics and lobbying in politics, it's difficult even for legislators, for members of Congress, to vote their consciences. And I think, you know, we're about to talk about guns, and we're going to be talking about Gino Auriemma and Chris Murphy. But the reality is, you know, after Newtown, those parents went down there. They thought they could get some kind of reasonable bill. I mean, you know, in polling, Americans support, you know, thorough background checks. And I'm sure, you know, after the latest round in Texas, there's probably more Americans who support thorough background checks. You can't get that bill passed, not because there isn't bipartisanship so much, but because members of Congress don't feel free to act in a way that's reflective of the temperament of the electorate.
So let's actually turn to the gun issue. And, of course, once again this week, we turn on the news or we see in our Twitter feed that there is yet another mass shooting in America. 26 people killed, people worshiping at a church. A man who clearly was disturbed on many different levels, who got thrown out of the Air Force, who should not have been allowed to have a gun. A lot of the things that we're finding about this killer, Colin, are very much different than what we saw in Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, we're not sure of what the motive is. People didn't see this coming. This is a guy who everyone in some way or other saw coming, but we didn't cross the T's and dot the I's and actually get the FBI the information needed to keep a gun out of this guy's hands. So that's one thing that I think it's important to talk about. Another thing is just watching the press conference with the governor of the state of Texas announcing what they knew about those killed and what had happened during that day. I saw this tone of resignation that I said on Twitter looked like we were watching a hurricane come through and we were in the center trying to batten down the hatches and let people know that we might have power outages. The sheriff of the town basically said to the media, don't say that these things shouldn't happen because they do happen. And I'm not sure if any of this changes a debate that hasn't been changed even when you see 20 young people get gunned down in a school in Connecticut. But it was really remarkable, the sense that people treated this like it was an act of God, like there's no way to stop a guy coming in and killing a bunch of people praying in a church.
Right. Well, I mean, here's one way in which the storm analogy is apt. You got one hurricane, you had one hurricane. If you have a bunch of, you know, 100-year, 500-year storms clustered together, then you start wondering whether something has changed, whether something has changed in the world. I think, what is it? We've had three of the four biggest mass shootings in American history in the last 17 months, something like that.
Yeah.
So when that happens, it's a little bit like the hurricanes, right? You just look at it and you say, all right, well, this, I mean, one shooting is one shooting, but now we're starting to see, in fact, a kind of a buildup here. Now, at the public policy level, I think the big mistake is trying to craft a law that will deal with the last shooter, all right? You know, you can't craft a law to deal with Adam Lanza or Dylan Roof or whoever it is. You need to craft laws that make sense. And a lot of these things are just common sense. Rather than look at the specifics of Texas this time, just look at the way guns come into people's hands and whether or not that makes sense. And I think you do start with background checks. And, you know, I don't know how we get that law. If we couldn't get it after Newtown, I don't think we're going to get it after Sutherland.
Mm. And Tom, obviously, as always, we see leaders in Connecticut standing up and really being at the front of the effort to shame Republican lawmakers, I suppose, who don't want to do anything about gun control. Chris Murphy kind of at the top of that list.
Yeah, Chris Murphy, I mean, people say that if he does get involved in the 2020 sweepstakes for president, it will be because of his fervent belief that something needs to be done when it comes to these gun issues across the United States. And if he feels that he can do that as running for president and using that as a kind of an issue, then he would throw his hat. If he feels he can do more good in the Senate. And even here at the local level, I mean, I look at Facebook posts on Themis Claridis's page, and people, when the question becomes of her running for governor, the people who are for the Second Amendment come out in droves, and they fill up the Facebook timeline, and they say, we're not voting for her, we're never going to vote for her because of that vote on Newtown, the Second Amendment stuff. So at least here in Connecticut, if you're a Republican, it's still a very potent issue, and a lot of people are walking the line on that one.
Mm. Bill?
It's been a truism of political analysis for the last couple of years that Republicans seeking higher office are more afraid of primaries than general elections. And I actually think that with the Manafort indictment and the Papadopoulos guilty plea, that's probably would be remembered as a moment in which that began to change. Republicans in yesterday's election goes to the same point. Not Themis or anybody else who's with the Second Amendment folks on that can't get elected in Connecticut. And so you can decide – you have to make an early decision about whether you can surmount the extreme primary opposition or speak to the majority. Just regarding the issue itself, I would just point one other thing out about it, and that is that if you look at all the polls on this stuff, and I have recently, whenever you ask people if we need to do more to protect gun rights or to encourage gun safety, the country is about evenly split because those are abstractions. And then as soon as you ask people about virtually all of the proposed remedies, there's 60, 70, 80, and 90% support for them. And the failure of Democrats to speak in concrete and specific terms and to employ logic and to do this sort of George Lakoff, it's all just a meme kind of communication, plays in the hand of the opposition. One of the reasons, to go back to Colin's thing again about Medicaid in Maine, one of the reasons we're the only developed country that doesn't have a sensible climate change policy and universal health care and a decent infrastructure and that we have the most debt is the same reason we're the only one with these kinds of gun laws. There is not a forceful, reasoned, specific, concrete blueprint on the table. And the moment we begin to remember that politics starts with building constituencies behind specific ideas, we'll be better off.
One of the people who did – I didn't even know about this before we went on the air, but Gino Auriemma wound up, just kind of taunting House Speaker Paul Ryan. One of his tweets was, Paul Ryan said prayer works in usual response to latest killings in Texas. Newtown is still praying you do something. How's that working? Gino actually does have kind of a knack for these things. And, of course, that's not the kind of reconciliation or reasoned debate or reasoned response that Bill's talking about. And I do agree with Bill about everything that he just said. But, you know, maybe Gino has a point that somehow or other you got to get these guys past the gun lobby, past the NRA rhetoric, push them past that to the table. Right now they're just not coming to the table to having that have that conversation. I don't know whether Gino has the right idea or not.
Well, I think he does. And, you know, and I guess either for good or for bad, he was on Twitter and he basically self-disciplined himself, unlike the president of the United States, and said, okay, I can't be on Twitter. The way I talk, I can't be on Twitter. He's finally back on Twitter recently within the last couple of weeks. And I think he does have a lot of things to say. And
I think the Democratic Party should get Gino in on candidate recruitment.
Same with Calhoun, and, too.
He should have a recruitment strategy.
But before we take a break, since we're talking about divisive political rhetoric and bipartisanship and everything else, I don't know, Colin, of all the strange stories of this week, the story of Kentucky Senator Rand Paul being tackled in his yard by a neighbor who he has a longstanding, I guess, dispute over landscaping about, resonates on a ton of different levels. One, it was a physical attack and a pretty serious physical attack on a well-known lawmaker and someone who has a pretty big political following. Another thing that I think a lot of people have taken note of is that the guy who broke several of his ribs and rendered him unable to get back to the Senate anytime soon is out on $7,500 bond, which an awful lot of, I think, people around the country would not be if they were to attack anybody or do just about anything. But I don't know, Colin. It's a strange story on a lot of different levels, and I also feel like there's a lot that we don't know about it.
Right. The Republicans are sending Greg Gianforte down there to do something about this guy. Gianforte, of course, is the Montana
tell
guy.
Who that is.
Who body slammed a reporter in a Montana election.
He's and then the got, third baseman for the Red Sox.
Right. And then got elected to Congress anyway. And so, I mean, to that point, I don't know. Once again, you don't want to extrapolate from some small stories to some big stories. But it's been a very kind of a violent couple of years here. There was a lot of violence at Trump rallies. We've seen violence in white supremacist rallies in places like Charlottesville. And we've even seen violence among politicians. I don't know. I mean, this thing looks like, to me, it's like more like a weird, you know, Frederick Barthelme New Yorker story than it is like that I recognize from real life. But it's been a strange, violent year. This story does seem to belong anyway in that storyline.
We might get to a couple more phone calls when we come back from a break. Maybe talk about Donald Trump's trip to Asia and a few more things. There's a lot to cover in the week's news with Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and Tom Dudchick from Capitol Report, both on the web and also on WTNH-TV. We'll be right back after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, with Bill Curry, and also with Tom Dudchick, editor at CT Capital Report. We always like to ask you what's on your site that you're really interested in right now, Tom. You got all these headlines of all these stories from municipal elections. What do you like?
No one better than in a hat tip to Colin, you know, from the death of Mary, Queen of Scots, a Montville, a 92-year-old woman listed as deceased, goes to walk into a voting booth in Montville, and they go, "Excuse me, I think you're dead." And then they go, "I'm not dead yet." And they walk him back. They walk him back to the and they show him. They go, "Look right here, deceased." You know, clearly was not deceased.
I have to fight every election to vote in West Hartford. It's like Zimbabwe where I go. Like I they turn me down every time. I've been sent away and come back.
Take that, Colin McEnroe.
In a primary for probate judge, so I could vote for Owen Egan. I had to visit the polls twice because I got turned away. Yesterday, like, I'm standing there, they're making phone calls about me. Like, a dog came up and voted, you know.
You're the
really,
person.
The dog's voting? I can't vote?
Let me just say that you went twice to vote in a probate judge primary.
I think
just speaks volumes to your character.
I think it's a job that the Irish should always hold. You can't screw it up, and it involves death.
Let's go to a couple quick phone calls. Marty's in New Haven. Hi, Marty.
Hi, how are you? I want to commemorate you on your wonderful panel, and Tom, it's nice to have Capitol Report back on the air. I think that your show can be summed up by an old John Bailey quote. John Bailey used to say that elections are made up of three components: a good candidate, good issues, and a good organization. That's what you guys have been talking about all day long, and that's what happened yesterday across the country for the Democrats.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for the shout out and the quote as well, Marty. Kathy's in Groton. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hi. Yes, I just wanted to report here from Groton in southeastern Connecticut that Democrats last night, we swept the town council, defeating many longtime incumbent Republican councilors, and we took over the RTM with a majority. Now,
congratulations.
Now this is a town with a lot of anti-Malloy sentiment, too, which is interesting. But many of the new Democratic office holders are new to local politics and directly from or inspired by the resistance movement. And while certainly the debate focused on local issues, you get the feeling there's a subtext there, or at least new energy in the Democratic Party because of the Trump administration. So... just my own opinion is, as a Democrat, I'm buoyed by this because I think that locally and nationally that we're going to rebuild the Democratic Party from the ground up.
So. Kathy, thank you so much for the phone call and the report from Groton this morning. Bill, a quick thought?
Again, it's new organizations becoming involved, and even more, it's new people. I bet that the second round of reporting in this election shows that there are more first-time candidates mm-hmm. running on the Democratic side than at any time in at least a generation. And this is going to be the last time a major reform election occurred in this country. I believe it was 1974 when the Watergate class came in. And those people, Toby and Tom Downey and George Miller, they weren't recruited by the Democratic Party. They challenged. They came out of nowhere. They won seats. And they made a big difference in this country.
And I think the
and that's what's happening. It's happening right now. This is 1974 writ large.
And I think the other is that you say in the second reporting of this election, I think it will show that women – have gained more office in the state of Connecticut. Yes. And I think a lot of people on the Republican side should probably look at that as far as what is appealing in 2018.
There's so many topics we still need to get to. We just got a couple of minutes left. Bill Kerr, you've got three of them. I'm going to give you a choice. Ready? This is a multiple choice. You get to either talk about Donald Trump and Asia, you get to talk about Donna Brazile and the state of the Democratic Party and Donna Brazile, or you get a chance to talk about Marco Jakin's plan to consolidate state universities. Go.
Okay, well.
Just one.
Yeah. I got you. It's a hard choice, but I'm going to go with the one people need to hear the most about here in Connecticut, and that is that that there is this plan on the table. Marco Jakin is a good, smart, principled public servant, but there's too much sort of technocracy in the Democratic Party, and there's too many people who prepare too many budgets and proposals behind closed doors without enough public input. The community college consolidation will take out the critical functions of curriculum and faculty from each of those institutions. This war in our politics is a war of the small against the big. There is no, in that proposal, no demonstrated evidence that there are real savings here. The savings that are achievable can be done without totally gutting the autonomy of the campuses. And as with all the budgets that Colin and you, and all three of you guys have pointed out, where we keep getting these surprises about the Department of Environmental Protection, about the Ethics Committee, there are all these unwelcome surprises buried in these proposals. We need to slow this process down, and we need to look at what we're throwing away here. It's the baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, I don't know. Bill and I talked about this on Sunday, and I'm not quite where he is on the higher education plan, but all of it depends on how students are treated. I've said this before. In other words, you need to be able to walk through the gate of a community college or one of the state universities, sit down with an academic advisor, explain what it is you're trying to do, and have them tell you, okay, here's the courses you need, and we have those courses right here on this campus. You don't have to go wandering all over the state just to find the basic credits you need to graduate. However we get to that, I'm not as fussy really about how it gets organized.
What do you see in this plan, Tom? I mean, this is a you got nothing.
Tom's indifferent.
I've been too busy following politics, John. I'm not a wonk.
Okay. you've been too busy following politics. Here's something you have been following. So another outcome of the budget and the agreement on the budget is that you guys may notice there's a little bit more room in here. We don't have the cameras CTN, the Connecticut
CTN
network.
To come here, yeah.
CTN isn't here because CTN basically is if not off the air, is not broadcasting any new content right now, looking to try to strike some sort of a deal with the state legislature. Tom, essentially, the legislature didn't want the CTN that we had before. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think at some basic level, we should be able to see the House and the Senate and a handful of important hearings. I think CTN got a little bit far afield. They were out there covering a lot of stuff and spending a lot of money. I think the legislature basically just wants them to cover the legislature, and which is the same model of C-SPAN in D.C., where they cover Congress.
Well, wait a second here. First of all, I really object to that. First of all, the legislature doesn't have the right to, or shouldn't have the right to tell CTN to just cover the legislature. And one of the problems
with
this.
Why not?
Because why can't they cover the Supreme Court? Why can't they cover the executive
branch? Let the Supreme Court pay for it.
Why should. No, the people of Connecticut pay for it. They pay for it in their cable bills, too.
That's wrong, too.
Yeah. I mean, so this is a vanity project by the legislature. They want this thing to be their little toy. They don't even want it to extend to the other branches of government. They don't own it. They don't pay for it. The ratepayers in Connecticut pay for it. I do like their new cop show, Looney and Fasano. That's actually pretty good. Can I just say one thing? If you're going to run reruns, rerun the Roland hearings, all right? You've got those on tape. They're great. If you have to put reruns on the air until you can do new stuff, they're gold. Those
all over
gold.
The world, whenever a government entity tries to get direct control over a broadcast unit, it is bad, bad policy.
It's state
it used
television.
To be against the law. In the United States for anything produced by the federal government to be broadcast within the United States.
And
that principle has been eroded because what ties together all the topics we couldn't get to and the one we did is the death of the democracy, that people think they can do things this anti-democratic, turn this independent broadcast institution into a megaphone for the party leaders. I'm surprised they had the gall to even suggest it, let alone do it.
Well, I remember we were talking about this off here. I remember at one point when C-SPAN started and there's politicians with grandstand, and Tip O'Neill said, oh, I run this, let me turn the cameras around, and showed these people talking to nobody in the House.
But Tom, it's not their toy. They don't own this. It does not belong to the legislature. They shouldn't be acting like it's their toy. Some of this broke down about money, about cutting their budget, but a lot of it broke down because these guys, these morons who have not been able to function effectively in running the legislature, think they deserve their own TV station.
Let's get Jerry Franklin down here. I think he can solve this problem.
Okay.
Don't tempt us.
Yeah.
Come on. This is in your wheelhouse, guys. This is what you do.
That's the name of the show. Tom Dudzik's got his own show. It's Capital Report. You can find it on WTNH on Sunday mornings.
We're hoping
you can also find him
online.
We're
to get Curry on this week.
Tom Dudzik, thanks so much. Good to see you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks also to Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst. Always good to see you as well, Bill.
My pleasure as always.
And Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Have a veggie burger.
Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. And, of course, our executive producer is Katie Talarski. You can always find us online at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.